Osho, Tao, The Three Treasures, Volume 2, Talks on Fragments from Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 9.
Bhagwan, on calm quietitude, Lao Tse said, the highest perfection is like imperfection, and its use is never impaired. The greatest abundance seems meager, and its use will never fail. What is most straight appears devious. The greatest skill appears like clumsiness. The greatest eloquence seems like stuttering. Movement overcomes cold, but keeping still overcomes heat. Who is calm and quiet becomes the guide for the universe.
Man is blind, though he has perfect eyes. Man is deaf, not that he has not got the ears. Man is dead, although fully alive. There is a seeing and seeing. There is a listening and listening. There is a life and life. And they differ tremendously. Eyes can see, but eyes cannot understand. And if you don't understand, what use is the seeing? Ears can hear, but unless ears are also attentive to what they hear, they will not be capable of listening. You are alive, but if you have not penetrated to your innermost core of being or non-being, only on the surface, your life is going to remain. You will never know. You will never come to an understanding of the tremendous energy phenomena that you were. You will die without being aware what life was. If you live in such a way that eyes see and yet not see, ears hear and yet not hear, the heart throbs and yet remains like a rock, you are alive in a physiological sense of the word. Medically, you are alive, but not existentially. Then what happens? Then all your understanding is like misunderstanding. Then it would have been better that you had no eyes. At least you will not have forgotten the fact that you are blind. At least you would have known that you cannot see. At least there would have been no possibility to misunderstand. Better it was you had no ears. Better it was you were not alive and really dead. At least there would have been some reality in it. A really dead person is at least really dead. But an unreally alive person is not really alive. He is in a limbo, neither alive nor dead. He drags. He doesn't exist. He has no inner dimension. He moves on the periphery without ever coming in touch with the center. And when I say these things about man, I am not talking about man as an abstraction. Whenever I say man, I mean you. My man is concrete, not abstract. My man is not a concept. It is you. And this is the way you have been living for many lives, living a dead life. That's why you are so bored, bored to the very bottom, so tired, tired of existing. Thousand and one times you think of committing suicide and drop all this nonsense. But even that you cannot do. Even that is not possible. Because a suspicion is always within you that there is much in life that you are missing. You know deep down somewhere, always follows you like a shadow. That possibility you may reduce to the concept of a paradise, a heaven, or a moksha. But that is nothing but a possibility of your coming really alive. If you live in such a way, everything in your life will be perverted. You see, but in your eyes there are tears. Then eyes are clouded. You see, but your eyes are filled with thoughts. Then the clarity is not there to see really. Then your thoughts interfere. If you see, and your eyes have many prejudices around them, those prejudices become a barrier. You see, and yet you cannot see. You have been hearing me, but I know rarely it happens that you hear me. Rare is the moment when understanding arises in you. Otherwise, you go on hearing me, but it is so dull. No intensity in it, no throbbing of being in it, that words go on falling on your ears, but nothing happens within. They don't penetrate. You don't give them your attention, your energy, your awareness. They can ride only on your attention and awareness and penetrate within words. You just listen to them. You listen as if you are in sleep and somebody is talking. You listen as if you are dead. I would like to tell you one anecdote. It happened in the life of a Sufi mystic. The man was not known much. He lived a life of absolute stranger in the world. In fact, he was known as the stranger, because nobody knew his name. He had never told anybody from where he comes, who he is. He moved from one town to another, and people became aware that he is the stranger with no identity around him, an original face with no mask. He came to die in a small town where Jalaluddin Rumi used to live. He came to die because of Jalaluddin Rumi. He died, and just a formality had to be performed before a man is buried. He has to be given a formal bath. So the professional Badr was called, and he cleaned the body of the saint. And when he was coming to the private parts of the saint, suddenly the dead body became alive as if, and took hold of the hand of the professional. And the fist was as if of iron. Of course, the professional became so afraid, scared to death. A dead body has gripped his hand. He started crying, screaming. People gathered. Every effort was done. But the dead man's grip was so strong that it was impossible to make that professional free from his grip. Then somebody remembers, it is better to call Jalaluddin Rumi, he may know something. The whole town gathered. Came Jalaluddin Rumi, he whispered in the ear of the dead man that he is just a professional. He does not know the state of your being. He does not know who you are. Forgive him for his transgression. Immediately the fist opened. Sufis have been talking about this story for hundreds of years. What happened at that moment? I don't know whether this is true or not, but that is meaningless. The story is beautiful and carries a message that a man of awakening is alive even when he is dead. This is the meaning to me. And the man who is not alert and aware is dead even while he is alive. The dead body was not dead, and your living body is not alive. Life means intensity of life. You live in such a diluted way, so unconcentrated, so spread over, that you never come to know what it is that you call life. Then you will do one thing continuously, and that will be misunderstanding. All your understandings will be misunderstandings. One man came to see me. He was talking about his master. And he said, that man is very humble. Even sometimes he has touched my feet. He is so humble and so simple. I told the man one story. It happened that somebody asked a Sufi mystic, Junaid. It was known that Junaid had lived almost with all the great masters of that time while he was learning and was seeking and searching. People wondered how he had known that these are the real masters. Because there are 1,000 pretenders to one real master. How this man had the capacity to immediately judge who is real. And he avoided the pretenders and always went to the real. When he himself became enlightened, somebody asked, "One thing has remained a mystery to us. How you could know when you were yourself not enlightened? What was your criterion? Almost always you were right. What knack you have got? Is it just a hunch that somehow you know, or you have a method in it?" Junna said, "I had a method in it. I will go to a person who is known to be a master, and I will be so humble, so self-effacing. I will touch his feet, tears flowing from my eyes. I will fall down on the earth. I will completely self-efface myself, and then I will watch. If, seeing my humbleness, the man became arrogant, domineering, I will escape him as somebody escapes a plug. I will escape him fast, as fast as I can." The inquirer asked, "And if the man didn't become domineering and possessive then, and dominating and arrogant then?" Said Junaid, "If I was self-effacing and I saw that the other man, the master, also became self-effacing, humble, I touched his feet and he touched my feet, then too I will escape as fast as I can." The inquirer was more puzzled. He said, "I had come to solve the mystery. You have made it more difficult. In both the ways you will escape. Then how you will be there? How the master has to react?" Said Junaid, "He has not to react at all. Whether I self-efface myself or not, he has to remain himself. If he becomes arrogant, that too is a reaction. Seeing a humble man, he wants to dominate. If he becomes humble himself, seeing a humble man, now he is in competition. He wants to prove that I am more humble than you. That too is arrogance. Very subtle. But that too is ego. That you cannot prove that you are more humble than me. He will start self-effacing himself. I will escape from both types of people. I will be with the person who simply looked at me and remained himself. He will not react. That man has attained to equilibrium, to balance. What Hindus call that man has become a sthitaprajna, a man whose inner flame of consciousness does not move now. With no wavering insight, he does not react. He has no mind to react. Whatsoever you do, it is the same to him. You cannot disturb him in any way whatsoever. Then I will remain with the man. So I told this man who was talking about his master that he is so self-effacing that when I touch his feet, he also touches me. I told you, go again. And this time you don't touch his feet and act arrogant and talk in such a way that you are higher than him. He said, it will be difficult. I have been a devotee for many years. I said, you don't worry, you have to try it. Only things will be clear then. Then you come to me. He went. Just after a week he came back and he said, everything changed. When I didn't touch the feet of the man, he didn't touch mine. And he looked with such condemnation towards me, as if it was possible for him, he will throw me to the seventh hell. And when I acted arrogantly and started talking as if I know more than him, he ordered his disciples to throw me out. I have been thrown out. I asked the man, now what you say? If you go to a man, if he behaves according to your ideas, you will have a misunderstanding. If he does not behave according to your ideas, then too you will have a misunderstanding. You have fixed ideas that don't allow to understand. You have formulas, and a man of understanding has no formulas about himself. He lives in the moment and lives freely. Remember this. He lives in the moment and lives spontaneously. He follows no ideology. Ideologies are only for fools, stupid people who are not alert. They are substitutes for awareness. Because you are blind, because you cannot understand, some substitutes to regulate your life and to discipline it have been given to you. But if you understand, you throw all those substitutes. Now you have the real thing. You live with awareness. But how you will be able to understand a man who is free? You are slaves. Slaves this way or that. Even if you rebel, you are slaves. Rebellious slaves, but still slaves. How can you understand a free man in your slavery? The slavery will surround you like a smoke, a screen. And through that slavery you look at a free man. Whatsoever you will see will be a misunderstanding. Whatsoever you will understand can never be understanding unless your eyes are completely clear of all smoke and all ideology, all fixed ideas, images, theories, concepts. Unless you come to a free man with a spontaneous being, alert of course, but with no idea, with no mind, only then you can judge. It happened. Junaid was passing from a forest near a lake. He saw a man. The very appearance was that of a drunkard. And there was a woman also with the man. Of course, immediately the mind starts working. Because why this man is here with a woman? Interpretation. And then he was pouring something from a surahi, a decanter. Must be wine. Woman and wine together and the isolation of a forest, things became clear. He thought he has understood. Then there was a storm and a small boat side of the lake and it drowned. The drunkard jumped. The saint could not gather courage to jump in the storm to save those men. He saved 6 men out of 7, and then he was absolutely tired. Then he said to Junaid, "You are a great saint. Why are you standing there? Why can't you do something? Now only 1 man is left. You can save him. Otherwise, remember, his blood will be on you. I have done whatsoever I could." Suddenly, Junaid became aware that he was thinking about this man, that he is a drunkard, a womanizer, a corrupt man, a sinner. But he has done something which is more saintly than he has ever imagined. And he couldn't gather courage. It was dangerous. It was a risk. He could not gather courage for the 7th man also. The drunkard again jumped and brought the 7th man also out of the lake. Then he started laughing, and Junaid asked, "Why are you laughing?" He said, "You come nearer and closer." He threw the veil from the woman's face. She was a very, very old woman. Junaid came to know that she was his mother, the man's mother. And in the decanter, in the surahi, there was nothing but pure water. But all that you can do is to judge from the outside. Immediately your mind starts spinning. You see a certain thing and there is no gap. The mind starts spinning. It creates an interpretation. Your interpretation is not reality. You are unreal. How your interpretation can be real? From an unreal being, only an unreal interpretation is possible. Drop all interpretations, all judgments. If you want to know a real man of awareness, a Buddha, a Christ, then drop judgments. It is very, very difficult to drop judgments and to remain without judgment, just to watch. Just to see and just to allow things take their own course. If you don't do that, this will happen what Lao Tzu says. He says, the highest perfection is like imperfection. To you, of course. If you come to a perfect man, it will look like imperfection. Why? It is very subtle, but try to understand it. A man who is really perfect is never a perfectionist. This has to be understood. And a perfectionist is never a perfect man. A perfect man is total. A perfectionist is fragmentary. A perfectionist has chosen a style of life and he goes on making it more and more cultured, polished. He can become very, very perfect, but he will remain imperfect because he has avoided many things which have to be incorporated. Otherwise, life cannot be perfect. Only a total life can be perfect. For example, a man has been trying not to commit any sin. And he has not committed any sin. He has lived a pure moral life. But this man, however perfect, will be imperfect. Because he has not known sin. Sin has some perfection to serve. It has some utility. Otherwise it would not exist. Devil is in the service of God. Otherwise there was no need for him. Devil may be acting against God, but that is too part of the whole drama. The devil has to be incorporated. If you deny it, a part within you will be denied. It is half of you. For example, if you deny anger, you deny hate, you deny all that moralists say wrong is wrong, you deny it all, then half of your being is denied. The night part, the dark part is denied. Only you accept the day. But the night is also there. Whether you accept it or not, it is there. That will remain in the unconscious suppressed. A saint always dreams of sins. Don't look at the saint, rather penetrate into his dreams, and you will find the sinner hiding there. People who try to become celibate always dream of sex. They will have to. People who try to manage their life with the day part, where they will put the night part? You cannot just destroy it. In existence, nothing is destructible. Everything is everlasting, eternal. It has to be absorbed. It has to be made part of your greater harmony. If you live a life of sin, you won't have any salt in you. You will be tasteless. If you live the life of a sinner, you will be only salt, not eatable. If you live a total life, the saint and the sinner meet and embrace each other within your being. The night and day meet and mingle and become one, as they should be. And then a third type of existence arises, the harmonious. Be tranquil. The balance, which is absolutely a different thing from night and day both. It is a third thing, which comes out of the meeting of two opposites. Oxygen and hydrogen meet, water is created. Water is absolutely different from hydrogen, from oxygen. It is a new existence. It is a new thing come into being. If you are thirsty, your thirst cannot be quenched by oxygen. It cannot be quenched by hydrogen either. Because the quality of water is neither in hydrogen nor in oxygen. The quality of water is a new quality, a harmony. When hydrogen and oxygen meet in a certain proportion, the quality to quench thirst arises. When night and day meet in a certain proportion, and that is the whole art of a yoga, Tao, religion as such. How to manage the harmony between the devil and the divine, the dark and the light, the summer and winter, life and death, how to create a harmony within them so that a third quality arises. That is Brahma, that is Tao. In English, you don't have any word for it. God, devil, heaven, hell, you have. you don't have any word equivalent to moksha or Brahma or Tao. Because Christianity, Jews, Mohammedans, they all have lived the life of a perfectionist, but not of perfection. They have tried to cut the lower, to destroy it, and just to remain with the higher. But this is sheer stupidity. It is as if you destroy the foundation and you want the higher part of the building to remain. It is as if you cut the feet and you want the man to be really alive and walking. The lower is a necessity. The lower is the foundation. Look at the economy of life. The lower can exist without the higher, but the higher cannot exist without the lower. And that's why it is higher. I am not creating a paradox. It is simple. The foundation of a building can exist without the building, but the building cannot exist without the foundation. A man can exist in darkness, but a man cannot exist alone in light. A man can exist the life of a sinner because it is lower, but a man cannot exist only with the life of a saint. The higher needs the lower. That's why it is lower, because it can exist without the higher. The higher is not a necessity for it. But the higher cannot exist without the lower. The roots can exist without the tree. There is nothing impossible in it. You can cut the tree, the roots will exist, a new tree will be born. But then try the other way, cut the roots. New roots will not be born. The lower is essential. The higher is a luxury. It comes only when the lower is fulfilled. It is possible only when the lower has been transcended, not destroyed. A man of totality allows the lower to be there, because that is the only way for the higher to be there also. And then he creates a harmony between the lower and the higher. In that harmony, lower is no more lower, higher is no more higher. They have become one unity. But if such a total man is seen by you, you will think he is imperfect. Because many things you will see which you don't like in yourself are there. You will see in the total man sometimes anger also. Of course, his anger has a totally different quality, but that you cannot understand. His anger has the quality of compassion. You also have anger, but your anger has not the quality of compassion at all. Your anger is violent. A man of totality has anger also, because the lower is to be there, but the higher has come into being. Now the higher shadows the lower, surrounds the lower. Now the higher has changed the quality of the lower. A Christ also becomes angry, but his anger is love. He is angry really because he loves you so much. People have asked me many times that we never come across Buddha, Mahavir, of any incident that they were angry. But we come across in the life of Jesus that he was angry. Was he less evolved than them? No. He was not less evolved. In fact, He was more total. As Mahavir. But he is more total than Mahavir. And he loves you more, and he loves you so much that sometimes if it is needed he becomes angry. Mahavir does not love you. He is simply non-violent. Try to understand this. He is indifferent towards you. Jesus loves you and loves you deeply. It is not surprising that Christianity became such a vital force in the world and Jainism remained an impotent branch, a dead thing. Why it happened? Jesus loves. And his love is so great that he is not afraid of being angry. He knows you will understand. If a parent is angry, and if he really loves the child understands. And never feels hurt. In fact, just the reverse will be the case. If the parent is not angry ever with the child, he will feel hurt because the parent is cold. He will never be able to forgive such a father or such a mother. Every day, many times, it happens in your life. People come to me sometimes. Just a few days before, one young man said that he was brought up by his stepmother. And he still feels very, very angry against her. He cannot forget her. He cannot forget her. And unless the conflict is resolved, he will not be able to go into meditation. Because even in meditations, he is thinking about the stepmother. How badly she behaved with him. How deeply hurt he feels still. He carries a wound. So he asked me how to heal this wound. I am always surprised whenever a person has lived with his stepmother, this happens. But I have never seen any stepmother to be more angry than other mothers are. Real mothers are even more angry than stepmothers. And real mothers beat the children more than stepmothers. They can afford it. Then why so much difference? There is a difference. The real mother loves also. That love transforms the quality of anger. If she is angry and she hits, the child knows that she loves also. In fact, the child comes to know by and by that she hits only hard because she loves. When a stepmother hits and beats or insults, then it goes very deep and hurts. The whole life it will remain like a wound. What is the matter? Because a stepmother's insult, rage, anger is cold. He does not love. Only the foundation is there, the building doesn't exist. Love transforms hate, anger, everything. Compassion becomes an umbrella. It changes everything that comes within it. A man who is a moralist, a Puritan, who has lived according to rules and who has followed them very, very seriously, you will think him perfect because you will never see any anger in him. You will never see anything that you condemn within yourself. He is just purity. But just purity becomes abstract, a concept. He is just a bubble of air, not substantial, because he has no foundation. In In fact, he is not good, just good. To be really good and substantially good, the opposite is needed. A totality is needed. It happened. Mulla Nasruddin was serving in a firm. Once the boss gave him a bottle of brandy. After 2-3 days, when Mulla didn't say anything, not even a thanks, the boss waited and then asked, "What happened to the brandy I gave to you? Was it good?" Mulla Nasruddin said, "Yes, just good." The boss asked, "What do you mean by just good?" Mulla said, "Just right." The boss says, "I don't understand. What do you mean by just right now or just good?" The Mulla said, "If it had been a little better, you would not have given it to me. And if it had been a little worse, I would have given it to somebody else. It was just good, just right." To be just right is nothing. It is a very mediocre state of mind. All your perfectionists, your so-called gurus, are almost always perfectionists, but they appeal you because you can see the picture clear. Whatsoever you condemn in yourself is not there. They are hot air bubbles with no substance in their life, no foundation. They are half. They are not complete. They are not total. They have denied much. And that which they have denied is still there in their subconscious, in their unconscious, is struggling hard to come up. That's why your sins, so-called sins, go on trembling. They are afraid of the sins that they have not committed. This is really something amazing. A sinner is not so much afraid of sins that he has committed. And a saint is so much afraid of sins that he has not committed, because they are inside knocking at the door. "Open the door and allow us." A saint is always afraid. That's why they used to move out of the town, out of the society, go to the Himalayas, go to a monastery. The word monastery is beautiful. It comes from a Greek root, which means to be alone. It comes from the same root as monopoly, monogamy, monotonous, that mon. That becomes monk. Monk means one who wants to live alone. And monastery means a place where people live alone. Even if others are there, but everybody lives alone in his own self. Why so much fear of the world? The fear of the world is the fear of the unconscious. Because if you are here in the marketplace, who knows, any moment the temptation may be too much. But if you have gone to a faraway monastery in the Himalayas, even if the idea of a woman, the fantasy, disturbs you, you cannot do anything. There is no woman. And by the time you reach Pune, the fantasy will be so dead, and you will have come again back in control. To go away from the world is to create a distance from the real world and your fantasy world. Because if you are really there in the marketplace and the fantasy takes over, you will not be able to control it. All perfectionists become escapists. They have to become. But you will see perfection in them. They are not real flowers, maybe plastic flowers. They can be perfect, but they have no fragrance. Fragrance is always of the total and the alive. One who has absorbed every tissue is like imperfection. Higher the perfection, the less you will be able to see it. Lower the perfection, the more you will be able to see it. In fact, you can see only those people who are just near you, just like you. You can understand them better in certain ways, but just like you. You may be more angry, they are less angry. The difference is of quantity, not of quality. You are a sinner, they are a saint. A saint means only all that you condemn as sin, he has also condemned and dropped within his own unconscious. He lives half-heartedly on the surface, always afraid of the roots inside, always trembling and praying God to save him from temptations. You can understand him. He is very close to you. The boundary line is not very big or solid. It is vague. But a real perfection, a real man of perfection, is so transcendental to you, it's so different from you, that you cannot understand him. Misunderstanding will be your only understanding about him. The highest perfection is like imperfection, and its use is never impaired. Its use is never impaired, because a man of totality is never finished. He is always growing and growing and growing. His perfection is not a dead, stale thing. His perfection is a process. His perfection is a continuum. He goes on growing and growing and growing. There comes no end to it. In real life, there is no end. Beginning and end are false words. Nothing begins and nothing ends. In the real life, everything goes on growing and on and on and on. Your perfection is a dead thing. A man comes to a dead end. Then he is just like a stone statue. No more a man. I have heard of an anecdote. A Buddhist monk came to India. After years, he went back to Japan. His master asked him, "What have you learnt in India?" The monk sat in a Buddha posture, closed his eyes, became completely calm, still. The master laughed and said, "We have already too many stone Buddhas here. Get out from here." There is no need for any more stone Buddhas, because the monastery where they belonged had 1,000 stone Buddhas already. It is called the Temple of 1,000 Buddhas. And the master was right that enough is enough. Get out of it. If this is all that you have learned, you wasted your time. Because you can sit still like a Buddha, but the inside, all the whole turmoil goes on. You can create a layer of stone-like inflexibility around you, that's what you call character. Character is a steel-like phenomena. Afraid of the inner tenderness, afraid of the inner living phenomena, you create a dead steel structure around you. That's what character is. A really perfect man has no character, cannot have, need not have. Only people who are afraid have characters. Character is a defense mechanism. Character is an armor. Not that the man of character is afraid of others, he is afraid of himself. Something may get loose and get out any moment. It is said that two persons should be silent. The man of wisdom should be silent because he has nothing to say. And the idiot should be silent because he can say something for which he will repent. A man of character is always afraid of something which he can do. He is capable of doing. Because whatsoever you repress has to be repressed again and again and again. He is always afraid he can do something for which he will repent. And such a life becomes an inner hell. A total man. Balanced. When I say balanced, don't misunderstand me, because in language it is a problem. Whenever such words are used, balanced, it feels the thing is finished, balanced. Now there is no movement in it, no progress. The whole language is created by a perfectionist. Few languages are there which are total. For example, Burmese is a total language because it was created after Buddha's religion reached Burma. Religion came first. It gave a new impetus to total being of the man, and then the language followed it. It is totally different language. When the Bible was being translated in Burmese, there was much trouble because these two languages are totally different. Burmese is a living language. Every word gives a hint of progress, of process, movement. The words are dynamic. And the words in the Bible, whether they be Hebrew or English, are dead. For example, in English I have to say balanced. In Burmese it will be balancing. In English we have to say experience. In Burmese it will be experiencing. It was almost impossible to translate Bible. Because how you will say God is? In Burmese it will become God is becoming. If you translate it in Burmese, it will become God becoming. Because there is nothing like is. Everything is becoming. Moving. You call the river is. Have you ever seen a river which is? It is always moving. It is rivering. Life is a lifing. But the word gives a dead concept. Life, finished. As if the circle is complete. So always remember that English are other languages. Hindi, Sanskrit. They are not parallel to life. They have created dead concepts. Everything is becoming. A total man is always becoming, always on the way. In fact, there is no goal for him, only the way. Buddha's sayings are collected in a scripture which is called Dhammapada. It means the way of Dhamma, the way of religion. Somebody asked me why it is called the way. Why not the goal? I told him there is no goal for Buddha. There is nowhere where you reach and everything is finished. It is always the way. And you are always the wayfarer. Always a traveler. Buddha used to give to his sannyasins names which mean. One he used to give is Parivrajak. It means a wanderer. One goes on wandering and wandering and wandering. And the more you become capable of wandering, the more you become capable of wandering. Both the words come from the same root. Only a wanderer can be a wanderer. Because every day new things are coming up. He is always moving. It is always fresh and new. And everything is unknown, unfamiliar, is strange. The wonder continues. Buddha used to give to his sannyasins another name. He calls Anagar. The word means homeless. And the meaning is there is no home. You go on and on and on. Buddha said, Chareveti, Chareveti, Chareveti. Go on, go on, go on. Life is an ongoing process. So really perfect man is never perfect in the sense that perfection is complete. He is always balancing, always. Never comes a moment when he can say, now, I have attained. Because if you say, I have attained, now you are futile. No meaning. You are useless. You are no more a part of this ongoing totality. The highest perfection is like imperfection. And its use is never impaired. It will look imperfection to you. And it has something of the imperfection in it also. Because imperfect things move towards perfection. And perfection always moves. It has a certain quality, aroma of imperfection around it. Otherwise it will be dead, finished. It happened that a Mohammedan ruler of Iran sent a wise man to India to make contacts with the Indian emperor, to make friendly relationships. The wise man came to India. He addressed the emperor of India as full moon. The emperor was very happy. He asked, "You call me full moon? What do you call your own emperor?" Mohammedans love the second day's moon very much. So he said, we call our king. The second day is moon. He is imperfect, sir. You are perfect. The emperor was very much pleased with many presents, many valuable things. He sent back with this wise man to his king. But the news reached before the messenger reached. There were in the court of the Iranian king people who were against this wise man. They said, he has insulted you. He has called you the moon of the second day. And he has called the Indian emperor the full moon. He is an enemy. He should be immediately caught. Of course, the king was so felt offended. Immediately the wise man entered the kingdom. He was caught and imprisoned and called to the court. The explanation was asked. The wise man laughed. He said, whenever something is perfect, it is dead. A full moon has nothing more to exist. The next day, it starts declining. The moon of the second day has much future. It goes on becoming greater and greater. I have not offended you. If the emperor of India was wise enough, he would have caught me immediately and imprisoned. You are a fool and your people around you are all fools. And he is true. Perfection is death. Because there is nowhere to go anymore. So, the total man has something of imperfection. And the aroma of imperfection, because he goes on moving and moving. He knows no death. He is deathless. And its use is never impaired. How it can be impaired when you are not imperfect, when you are not perfect? Your use will always remain. You will be useful always and always. In Indian kingdoms, in Jaipur particularly, few friends took me to a palace. They told me the history about the palace. That it has never been completed. Some astrologers said to the king that the day it is completed, you will die. So he continued working on the palace. Something or other, somewhere or other, there were always construction. The astrologer must have been a very wise man. He may not have been a great astrologer, but he must be a wise man. When you are doing something continuously, you are alive. That is the meaning of it. When the palace is being constructed continuously, everything is alive. When everything is complete, everything is dead also. That's why it happens, you may have sometimes even suspected that if you live with a man who thinks he is perfect, and you think he is perfect, you cannot find more boring a company. You may respect the man, but you cannot live with the man. He will be too much of a perfectionist. He will be a dead body. From far away, he is good. The nearer you come, he will start stinking. He is dead. Your all Mahatmas stink. You cannot live with them. You can appreciate from far away. But if you live with them for 24 hours, you yourself will feel that you are going to die. They are dead. Around them only death exists. They are perfect. They are the full moons. They have achieved, reached a real life is always reaching. Always reaching. It never reaches. It is always arriving. It never arrives. And that's the beauty of it. The greatest abundance seems meager, and its use will never fail. In fact, you sow your abundance because of your inner poverty. The more poor a man, the more he tries to show that he is rich. The more important a man, the more he advertises that he is very potent. The more ignorant a man, the more he pretends knowledge. The weaker you become, the more you want to create an illusion around you that you are very strong. In fact, whatsoever you want to sow will be just the opposite of what you are. If a man understands a little psychology, not much is needed. He can exactly judge where you are and what you are. A real man of knowledge will not sow his knowledge. There is no need. He is absolutely certain that it is there. In fact, he may hide it. He may try that he is a fool. He may try that he doesn't know anything. He may try that he is nobody, so that nobody disturbs him. And when you have the treasure, there is no need for others' opinion that you have the treasure. The need comes into being only when you don't have the treasure. Only opinions are there. You have to depend on them. What people think, you think too much about it. This is something of inner poverty. The greatest abundance seems meager. So don't be in a misunderstanding. If you reach to the richest man, you will not see any show of it. If you reach to the wisest man, he may look like a fool. Because he will not be showing, he will not be an exhibitionist. If you come across a beautiful woman, you will not find her painted, decorated, ornaments all around her body. This is how an ugly woman does. A real woman, a really beautiful woman, will not bother to paint her face, paint her body, put too many ornaments. This is ugliness that wants to sow beauty. Real beauty is completely oblivious of itself. It exists there in tremendous glory, but it doesn't sow, it doesn't exhibit, it doesn't advertise. You have to find it. You have to seek it. The greatest abundance seems meager, and its use will never fail. A man who lives a life of non-exhibition will always have enough, always more than enough than he needs. A man who lives an exhibitionist life will always be poor and will always be in need of more and more and more. Don't sow what you have, because that is the way you dissipate the energy. If you have power, hide it. Hide it within. So deep that only those can reach who have that power themselves. If you sow your power, soon you will become important, powerless. It will be taken from you, stolen from you, robbed. You will be persuaded to depart from it. Don't exhibit that which you have. Don't sow it. Enjoy it. Rejoice in it. Delight. But let it be absolutely unknown. Only those who know their own power will be able to know you. A man of power always immediately knows another man of power. A man of wisdom always immediately knows, without any outward symptoms, the man of wisdom. There is no missing about it. So those who are wise will know your wisdom. No need to sow it. In fact, if you try to sow it, you will be stupid before them. And those who need not know, no need to exhibit to them, because they will be the stealers. They will be the thieves. They will rob you of it. The greatest eloquence seems like stuttering. The greatest skill appears like clumsiness. And the greatest eloquence seems like stuttering. The greatest skill. Why it seems like clumsiness? Because the man of the greatest skill is not self-conscious about it. Have you seen Picasso's paintings? One of the greatest painters ever. And those who have seen his paintings, immediately the idea comes, they look like children's painting. That is the greatest skill, which looks like clumsiness. But you don't know. Try a Picasso painting yourself, then you will know. It is more difficult than great classical painters. A Michelangelo is absolutely perfect, but not total. Picasso is more total. A Michelangelo creates beauty which is not of this world or of another world. It is just abstract. Picasso paints the real. If the real is ugly, then in Picasso's painting it is also there. The beauty is there, the ugliness is there. The wisdom is there, the foolishness is there. Life is a totality. A wise man will be able to see in Picasso's paintings the wisdom. But it is childlike. Small children do paintings that way, as Picasso does it. But don't think that he was not trained. He was trained, disciplined. He became so perfect one day that he dropped all training and all discipline. It was not needed now. Now he can paint like a child. The greatest poet does not bother about the grammar. That is for amateurs, the beginners, to bother about grammar. A great poet, in fact, by and by, forgets language itself. He creates his own language. A great poet is unclassifiable. You cannot classify him. Only ordinary poets who look at the grammar, the meters, and the whole poetics they follow. They will look perfect to you because you cannot find a single fault in them. Try to understand me. A great poet will have many faults because life has many faults. A perfect poet will not have any faults, but then his poetry will not be alive. Only a dead body cannot err. To err is human, they say. I said to err is to be alive. Only life can err. Life has no perfect touch about it, and that's the beauty. It is childlike. So when a culture reaches to the highest peaks of its being, everything becomes childlike. The greatest painter starts playing with the paint. There are paintings of Salvador Dali, one of the most beautiful paintings. He will simply spread color on the canvas directly from the tube. And the painting is ready, playing with the color. You cannot see Salvador Dali's painting, which is upside and which is downside. You can put it any way. It is always right. Once it happened that Picasso was asked to give two paintings immediately within one day, and only one painting was ready. And a man like Picasso cannot be ordered. He lives spontaneously. The painting was not coming. The feeling was not coming to paint, so he cut the painting in two. And he sold the one painting as two, and nobody was ever aware that these are one or two. He could have made four. Then too it was not any different. Because nobody can make any sense out of it, what it is. It is just a play of colors. If you ask him what he is doing, what is the meaning, he will say, go and ask the flower, what is the meaning? If God can go on playing with colors without any meaning, what is the meaning of a butterfly and its colors? And what is the meaning of these jasmine flowers around here? Why they are red and not yellow? And why yellow, why not white? There is no explanation. Life is inexplainable. A great painter becomes like God. He plays. He creates sheer beauty, not forms. A great poet becomes like God. He creates sheer poetry, not poems. And a sheer poetry is totally different than poems. Poems have forms. A sheer poetry is formless. It may be in prose. Poetry can be in prose, but a poem cannot be in prose. Poetry can be in silence, but a poem cannot be in silence. A great musician forgets everything that he's learned. He forgets his instruments also. He himself becomes the music. Then when he is silenced, then too there is a singing. When he walks, there is a song in it. When he sits, there is dance in it. In his movement, there is dance. In his non-movement, there is dance. He has become one with it. That's why Lao Tzu says, the greatest skill appears like clumsiness. It is difficult for you to understand it. To understand Michelangelo is easy. Any fool can understand. But to understand Picasso, it is difficult. Only few mad wise people are needed who can understand it. Mad and wise both. The greatest eloquence seems like stuttering. The greatest man of eloquence always hesitates. Life is so subtle. How can you say something without stuttering? Life is so profound. How can you put it into words? Life has such depth, immense depth, that only a fool can say something without hesitation. Only a fool can be certain. A wise man is always uncertain. He walks as if he is walking and passing a winter stream. He walks cautious, as if on every step there is death. He says, knowing well that all that can be said is rubbish, and that which is not rubbish cannot be said. Knows well that there is no possibility to say the truth, because the moment you say it, it becomes a lie. Words kill it. They are poisonous. Only in silence it can be said, but there is nobody to understand silence. So a wise man also has to speak. But he stutters. He hesitates. He is always afraid anyway. Not for himself, but for others. Whenever I speak to you, I know. There are 99% chances for it to be misunderstood and only 1% chance to be understood. How can I say it with certainty? I have to hesitate, but the risk has to be taken for that 1%. The possibility of 1% people understanding, the risk has to be taken. The song has to be sung, knowing well that maybe nobody will understand it. The painting has to be painted, knowing well that maybe nobody will be there to appreciate it. It happened in Van Gogh's life, a great Dutch painter. He painted in such a spontaneous way that nobody could understand what he paints. There existed no criterion to judge his paintings. And in fact, how there can be criterion before Van Gogh is there? The criterion will follow Van Gogh. It cannot precede. Other painters were there in the world, but there have never been a Van Gogh. So how there can be criterions, critical standards to judge a Van Gogh? Van Gogh brings a new world to the world. He painted, but no paintings were ever sold. But that was not the point. He was never depressed about it. If he had come across Laozi, he would have said, if people purchase them, then they are not real paintings. Because nobody purchases them, there must be something in it. Nobody could understand the head or tail of them. His brother used to give him enough money just to meet his bare necessities, food, clothing, shelter. Not even a single pie more. So he will eat 4 days and 3 days he will fast. Because he had to purchase color and canvas to paint. So this was the pattern for his whole life. He didn't live long. This world is not for people like that. They simply remain outsiders and strangers. They simply don't feel at home. He painted madly because he knew that life is ebbing soon. How can you live for your long life just 4 days eating? Not efficient food. And then 3 days every week fasting. But he painted and he was happy. The brother, his brother, Theo van Gogh, he was very, very depressed because of it, because no painting can be sold. And he himself was a great critic of paintings, the brother. And he supported, he tried to sell, but no painting could be sold. Just to make Van Gogh happy, once he sent a friend with money to purchase at least one painting. The man came. Van Gogh was very happy that at least somebody has come to appreciate. He sold all his paintings. Almost 200 paintings, his whole life effort. But the more he sold, the more he understood that the man does not understand. He is in a hurry to purchase any. So he said, I am not going to sell. I suspect that my brother has given you money. He turned him out of the house. And that was the last thing. He said, never again I am going to sell anything. He simply gave his paintings to anybody and everybody. The tea house on the corner of the street, he will go and give the paintings. After his death, the hunting started. He had created a criterion for himself. This is really something. A man like Van Gogh has to paint and create a criterion also, so that those paintings can be judged, because there exists no criterion. A man like Lao Tse has to create his truth, and then the methods, how that truth can be seen and realized. After his death, his paintings became so famous that they were hunted all over Europe, wherever he had lived, in small villages, in hotels, in tea houses, in coffee houses. And people had thrown them in rubbish. They had completely forgotten about them. Now there exist almost 100 paintings rediscovered. And each painting almost cost 10 lakh rupees. That is the minimum. And the man lived like a beggar. Nobody ever purchased. What is the problem with the greatest? There is a problem. That such a distance exists between them and the masses. And the distance is so vast, there are only two possibilities. Either the great man comes down to the masses, which is impossible, because that cannot happen, that is unnatural. Or the masses reach higher. That is the only possibility. It takes time. That's why even thousands years pass and Buddha and Lao Tse and Krishna remain enigmas. The mystery is not solved. The greatest eloquence seems like it's stuttering. Movement overcomes cold, that you have observed. You go to the physiologists, medical doctors, they will say, yes, movement overcomes cold. That's why when there's much cold, your body starts shivering. That is body creating its own movement to overcome cold. Shivering is nothing but a mechanism of the body to overcome cold. When you shiver, the body starts trembling. A movement is created all over the body. That movement gives you heat. That you know. That everybody knows. May not be aware, but everybody knows. If you are feeling cold, you walk fast and you overcome it. You run and you start perspiring. Even an imaginary movement can overcome cold. In Tibet, there exists a particular method they call heat yoga. You simply imagine. You try sometime when the night is very cold and winter is there. You just sit naked in the room. You feel the cold, then close your eyes and just visualize that you are running fast. Round and round the house, not actually, just in imagination. And by and by you will feel the body is not feeling any cold. And if you really run fast, or you imagine that you are climbing Himalayas and it is very hard and you are carrying a load, you will start perspiring. That's how Tibetan lamas live almost naked in the Himalayas, where everything goes frozen, where snow has been eternal, never melted. They sit there naked and they start perspiring. Just imagination. Even imaginary movement can overcome cold. The same exists from the other side also, that you have to remember. That's the whole secret of meditation. Movement overcomes cold, but keeping still overcomes heat. You are so heated up, so tense, so uneasy inside, it is a feverish state of being. Keeping still overcomes heat. You just keep still. That's why so many methods exist in which you simply sit silently. You allow your breathing to become more and more and more silent and calm and quiet. Nothing else is to be done. In Japan, they have a method they call Zazen. One simply sits and allows every body process to calm down. That starts from the breathing. You breathe as slowly as possible, as if by and by there comes a point where is almost no breathing, or very shallow, and suddenly you realize that with the calm breathing and the body is still, the mind has stopped, the feverishness has stopped, the monkey inside is no more jumping so hard. You have overcome the spiritual fever. Or you simply imagine. That can also be done. You walk, but you imagine that inside you are not walking. You work in the workshop, in the office, in the shop, but inside you imagine that you are not working. This is only the body working. You run as much as you want, but inside you remain calm and quiet and feel that you are a witness of the running. You are not the runner. And you will overcome heat, tension, inner uneasiness. Movement overcomes cold. Keeping still overcomes heat. Who is calm and quiet becomes the guide for the universe, not because he tries to become the guide, simply because he is calm and quiet. All those who are in real search anywhere in the world, they start coming to him. It is a natural phenomenon. Just as waters go on moving towards the ocean, and all the rivers fall there. If somebody has really become calm and quiet, millions of rivers who want to be silent, who want to be calm and quiet, go on falling into that man. A Buddha is born. When you are silent, suddenly you are the guide. One need not become the guide. You are the master. One need not become the master. If you try to become the master, you will be a teacher. And a teacher is a very poor thing. If you don't want to guide anybody, you will find disciples coming and falling into your ocean. You have become the master. Enough for today.